طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. This week, our feature presentation is a rebroadcast of an interview shared with This Week in Palestine by the television program The Arabic Hour. Moderator, local Palestinian activist Nancy Murray, speaks with Palestinian activist Nidal al-Azraq and black activist Ajamu Dillahunt, focusing on the parallels between the Palestinian and black struggles for freedom and equality. This conversation begins with introductions by Nancy Murray.
Welcome to the Arabic Hour. My name is Nancy Murray. Today we will be addressing issues of immense current interest and importance around the unifying theme, Black Lives Matter, Palestinian Lives Matter. We must start by acknowledging that the struggles for Black and Palestinian liberation have their own unique histories and their own particular experiences of racialized state violence in what are both settler colonial states. But there are also striking parallels between what African Americans and Palestinians are dealing with that we will focus on in this discussion. We have seen expressions of Black Palestinian solidarity at Standing Rock, North Dakota, during protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, at Ferguson, Missouri, following the police killing of Michael Brown, and this summer, during thousands of protests in the U.S. and around the world following the murder of George Floyd. These expressions of solidarity can be traced back to the upheavals of the mid-1960s. In 1964, Malcolm X visited the Gaza Strip, and a few years later, black activists who identified with anti-colonial liberation movements labeled Israel a product of Western imperialism. Like Malcolm X, many African Americans today identify with Palestinian struggles for freedom, equality, human rights, and what Angela Davis calls, quote, the indivisibility of justice. So now I'd like to introduce two guests and welcome them to Arabic Hour. First, we have Nidal al-Azraq, who is a Palestinian refugee born and raised in Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem in the West Bank. He is currently working as executive director of 143.org US. It's a US-based organization that focuses on water, food, health, and environmental work in Palestinian refugee camps. He has been involved for over 15 years in working with young Palestinian refugees in camps in the West Bank through human rights, empowerment, and political education projects. We have joining us from North Carolina, Ajamu Amiri Dillahunt, who is a PhD student in history at the History Department of Michigan State University, and one of a rising generation of powerful young black activists. He is a member of Black Workers for Justice, a former intern with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's Digital Gateway Project at Duke University. He also participated in the historic Demilitarized Durham 2P Palestine Coalition, which he will be describing later on today. But let me start with you, Nidal. You come from a family that has long been in the front lines of struggle. Can you tell us about your background and the work you have been doing in Palestine?
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. It is a real pleasure and honor to be with you and Ajamo here on Arabic Hours. I am the youngest in a family of 8 brothers and 3 sisters. Grew up in a refugee camp. You know, with a mid-sized family growing up in a refugee camp with little resources, living and growing up under a brutal Israeli occupation with the fewer services from the UNRWA. And you are, you know, living in such a bliss, known by creating troubles, good troubles, you know, and which means you are not a favorable of subject of all kind of authorities. On top of that, being a refugee living in the refugee camp, there is a lot of things that reminds you of who you are every day. For example, you know, I'll wake up in the morning and take a walk in the camp, and I'll see the United Nations, the UNRWA workers with their UNRWA vests, their schools, they have this big UNRWA sign on them, the UNRWA office, all of, and the crowdedness of the place. All of this reminds you of who you are. You're still a refugee, and a refugee in your own country. So your struggle's still going on, you know. And all of these factors have pushed us to start thinking about 2 things in our family, like other families in Palestine. It's like our identity and memory, you know, who we are and how this part of our identity of being a refugee was forced on us. You know, we did not choose to become refugees. We were forced out of our original villages in 1948 during the Nakba, the catastrophe, to become refugees settling in refugee camps. And you will start asking the questions, you know, living in these conditions. How did we end up in this place? How did that happen? And who's responsible? And this kind of situation, it's either, you know, like anything in life, it's either you, when something is being enforced on you, it's either you accept it or reject it. So my family, like many families in Palestine, did not choose to accept it and obey the colonizers' rules. They chose to reject the living conditions, reject the occupation, reject this inhuman type of life. And with that, it came a high price, you know, a high price in the struggle, such as, you know, spending over 30 years in prison. You know, I'm talking about my brothers and sisters struggling against the occupations. We faced house demolitions, tortures, interrogations, subjugated to different kinds of shooting and injuries, and a lot of, among other non-pleasant events, you know, that we did as a family. About the work I have been doing in Palestine, again, growing up in this type of a family, in such difficult yet empowering conditions, you look at the struggle from 2, you know, important sides. There's the resistance with all its form for freedom, you know, and liberations. And there is the human aspect of the struggle. So the human aspect of the struggle, which taking care of your community, providing them with knowledge, skills, and basic life necessities, to provide them with respect and dignity. So I spent most of my life between 2002 until now working with in refugee camps, with mostly with youth and college students on issues like youth empowerment, political education, especially around identity and memory and history and leadership, etc. And the other side is, you know, like now working with 1-4-3, keep trying with a team here in the U.S. and Palestine to build projects that are owned and run by the local communities in Palestine, such as the right to water, to food, to education, and to the environment.
Okay, thank you for that. Ajamo, we know each other from a trip we made together to Palestine in 2018, and among other places, we visited the Lodgy Center in Ida Camp, where for many years Nidal was working. Were you prepared for what you encountered in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and what were some of your strongest impressions? Did you, as a young African American, feel many points of connection?
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, very difficult to prepare oneself for the inhumaneness of the occupation. But prior to the delegation, I was very well aware of Palestine and had firmly, you know, expressed my support for Palestine. In 2014, as a high school student working to end the school-to-prison pipeline in my local school district, the organization in which I was working with held a freedom school, and there they began to talk to us about U.S. imperialism and basically showing us that the struggle to end the school-to-prison pipeline was part of a much broader, much more international, much more complex struggle. And a part of, you know, the complex and international character of the struggle, they introduced us to the Palestinian struggle for freedom. And, you know, since learning about it and talking with my grandparents about it, you know, as a high school student, I was giving speeches on the importance of Black and Palestinian solidarity. But it was very limited, of course. I mean, of course, you had the Dream Defenders taking a delegation, and of course, you had what took place in Ferguson. So my understanding of the connections between Black and Palestinian solidarity was much organized around the military aspect or the militarization piece. So, of course, around the tear gas being used in Palestine, the same being used in the U.S., and, you know, the mass incarceration aspect, political prisoner struggle, and, of course, the exchanges that U.S. Police officers were doing with the Israeli occupying army. But when I went and, you know, actually in Palestine, I was transformed on a number of fronts. But one was that our struggles are much more similar than what I had understood before going. In terms of education, the occupation tried to suppress the Palestinian consciousness of their history and contributions to the world, similar to how the U.S. tried to suppress peoples of African descent's understanding of their history and culture and contributions to the world. So there was a similarity in terms of the crisis of the consciousness of our people and the direct attempt amongst the power structure to prevent us from asking questions about the world and being able to fight back. I remember one day, it was in 2018, you know, it seemed so close, but it was so long ago. We went to one place, and they were telling us that during the Antifada, the occupation banned books. So that, you know, Palestinian comrades couldn't, begin to read, ask questions, and develop strategies. And so, you know, as, you know, 45 has tried to implement this patriotic type of curriculum that can't be in any way critical to the U.S., you know, we see these trends, you know, that's been a part of the U.S. For quite some time. So, you know, I recognize that the struggles was much more deeper, although there were differences in terms of context, which I think is important, but how we were oppressed was very, very, very similar.
So in the U.S. this summer, we've seen really phenomenal scenes, not just across the U.S., but across the whole globe, of people taking to the streets in protest at the killing of George Floyd. Protests have taken place literally, I think, about at least 7,000 times in this country. And on a single day of June 6th, there were reported to be 500,000 people participating in demonstration in as many as 550 sites across the country. It seemed to me, at least, that, you know, things were really now going to shift. And I'd like to hear your thoughts, both of you, about the movement for Black Lives protests, where they could lead, and the way they have been dealt with by the police, the National Guard, and other security forces. Nidal, I'll ask you to start. Has what you saw on the streets this summer reminded you at all of Palestine?
Yes. Well, first, you know, anyone lived in a colonial society can relate to Black Lives movements, you know, and the struggle here. And as a Palestinian, especially since I moved to the U.S. here in 2006 from Palestine, I have been always inspired and learning about the Black struggle in the U.S. Besides the reading and learning about the Black history and struggle here in the U.S. as a Palestinian growing up under the occupation, there are a lot of events that happened here in the U.S. that reminded me of the situation in Palestine, and to recall one or two examples that really, you know, created this curiosity inside me to follow up on these issues, especially in the collaborations between the political and police systems here and Israel and oppressing the people. I remember, you know, in 2000 and I think 2011, there was a lot of protest in St. Louis in response to the killing of Anthony Lamar Smith. And at that time, during the protests, you know, there was a lot of tear gas in the streets against the protesters. And there's also, they used the a truck. They start calling it, when I start watching the videos, they called it the skunk truck. And when I heard this phrase, the skunk truck, I said, wait, hey, I know this truck. We also call it the skunk truck in Palestine. You know, it's to spray the gray water or the smelly water on the protesters. So this took really my attention. So I started digging deep to know that this specific truck there in St. Louis was made in Israel, and the police department, they bought it from Israel. So and this, to me as a Palestinian, created this notions like the protesters in St. Louis there at that time, without them knowing, they were like sharing some kind of an experience with me as a Palestinian living in the U.S. And this is really created this really, and it's like, how could that happen, you know? And digging deep in the issues and getting involved with activist groups and groups who are doing the exchange between the police here in Israel, I learned that the police system and department here in the U.S., they have offices in Tel Aviv, you know, and they do the training and all the techniques. And I saw that this unity between the two law enforcement systems here and in Israel. And I start thinking like, if these two oppressive racist systems manage to find a unity and collaborations, why is it hard for us as people to find a common ground and unite, not only here in the U.S., actually, globally? And then events after events start to happen, especially the one you mentioned, 2014. In 2014, as we might know, there was a war in Gaza, you know, where like over 1,000 people were killed in this war. Half of them were children. And at the same time, there was the uprising in Ferguson, you know, in response to the murder of Michael Brown. And at that time, Palestinians actually start, without recording them, through Twitter and other means, start giving advices to the protesters in Ferguson and to advise them how to deal with tear gas. And solidarity of statements start to come from Palestine in support of the Black Lives movement here in the U.S. And at that moment, it was a reminder to a lot of people here in the U.S. and in Palestine, but especially here in the U.S., the ones who were involved in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was a reminder of the long history between the Black struggle and Palestine struggle. And if you look at, you mentioned also George Floyd, we saw that, you know, the killing of George Floyd have sparked a global, you know, a moment for Black lives, you know, and I really think a Black life movement here in the U.S. is in a great and special position to start building bridges and unite these struggles around the world. They have done an amazing mobilizing, and I think it's the time for all of us to start also adding the organizing aspect on top of mobilizing to start to connect and strategize not only between Palestine and the U.S., but also globally.
That's a very good point. Jamal, how do you see the movement for Black Lives protests? Where do you think they're going to take us?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that, you know, people are in the streets and are demanding that a better world be built and that true transformation takes place. And while being in the streets is historic, You know, we have to begin to understand that revolution is a process. And as you know, I mean, I'll mention, you know, it takes organization. We must be organized in the movement for Black Lives in terms of this period, but also the movement for Black Lives as an organization, such coalition, is really beginning to try and provide organization that is needed for this period. Whether it be the BREATHE Act or whether it be work that organizations who are part of the movement for Black Lives are doing, there's some form of revolutionary organization and leadership that has taken place. But also, we have to be critical. We have to understand, you know, and be critical that the empire wants us to keep our struggle domestic. And so, you know, while there's been uprisings in other parts of the world in solidarity, I think it's a responsibility of anyone who is conscious to try and build, not just, you know, in rhetoric, with people who are oppressed by the U.S. and other parts of the world, but that we come together, strategize, think through things, and while the empire is at its knees, we bring it fully down to its knees and we attempt to destroy it. There's oftentimes been this position that, you know, given the uprising that has taken place in the U.S., let's just focus it narrowly on this one thing. But, you know, I think we do a great disservice, and it shows a lack of understanding of what revolution is if we approach this moment in a narrow fashion. So there have been efforts to connect policing to the questions of the environment, connect policing to health, and most importantly, connect the question of policing to the inhumaneness associated with capitalism. And so these are young people who are moving with a sense of urgency that have been impacted by 2014, by 2012, by Trayvon Martin. So, you know, it was a historic period then in terms of engagement. And so then for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor to take place, you know, we've reached a point of uncompromising, of intense mobilization to really bring about some form of transformation.
I want to turn back to something that was briefly mentioned before, which were police trainings from the U.S. going to Israel. And I know, Jama, you were involved in this path-breaking campaign in Durham, North Carolina, to stop local police from being trained in Israel. And I'd like you to describe the campaign and tell us, why was it successful and what has the aftermath been? Was there serious pushback?
Yeah, so the Demilitarized Durham to Palestine campaign has its roots, I like to say, in the anti-apartheid movement that took place in the 1980s in Durham and, you know, other parts of North Carolina. The groups that came together in 2016 had known each other long before then, had been engaged in other areas of struggle, whether it be Palestine or whether it be struggles for economic justice, struggles, you know, for racial justice. I mean, these groups that came together, we had a sense of revolutionary trust amongst each other. And so, you know, I like to say that it has its origins, you know, in the anti-apartheid movement. And we use that to fuel our work. And many of the participants were part of the anti-apartheid movement that took place in Durham. So this was really a mature coming together of organizations. And in large part, you know, with students, UNC Students for Justice in Palestine, Duke Students for Justice in Palestine, the Black Youth Project 100, this organization by the name of Spirit House, Jewish Voice for Peace, the Abrahamic Initiative in the Middle East. I mean, it was a group of forces who had a level of trust. And so as we were approaching city council and as we were trying to raise the consciousness of the local Durham community, we had that strong history and support from each other to build upon. So as, you know, coalitions are beginning to emerge, it's important to know that, you know, before you move forward and you take on a campaign like this, it's important to establish that sense of trust. And then, you know, at the campaign, it was an electoral strategy. So when we launched, it was, you know, an election season for Durham. So at every event, we made sure that the question of these exchanges were on the agenda. And then someone who had been elected to city council, been a part of the movement for quite some time, her name was, you know, Jillian Johnson. She was an undergrad at Duke. She even traveled to Palestine. She was on the council, and an event took place at North Carolina Central University, my university, a historically Black college, where I did my undergraduate studies on Lincoln liberation struggles. And the city councilwoman gave a presentation on the importance of Black and Palestinian solidarity. And so we had this kind of momentum going into the campaign, a relationship, electoral type of relationship that allowed us to move forward. But the campaign was important. the coalition still exists and is still pushing forward, demanding, a just society, trying to achieve a victory for oppressed people in Durham and, for Palestinians. So it was a transformative experience for me being an undergrad, and being a part of the, coalition, but also taking that discussion from the coalition into the classroom and taking what I learned in the classroom to the coalition. And so it was, a campaign that increased Black and Palestinian solidarity, in my opinion, in profound ways. We had, so in February, before we got our victory in 2018, we had an event in the Department of History. I was asked to give a lecture on the history of the Civil Rights Movement. And so, I did that, and I also recognized we were in an important, time period for the campaign, and that the Civil Rights Movement had an international character to it, and the 1960s more broadly did. The Black freedom struggle beyond decades of history has always been international. But, so I gave a talk, and since I was talking to young students, I gave a talk on SNCC. And, in 1967, SNCC released a statement in support of Palestine. So I ended my presentation there and then said why it's critically important today to take SNCC's position very seriously and support the Palestinian struggle for freedom. And, these weren't the usual suspects that come to every event. These were students, who were on campus, who were, involved in church stuff on campus. And, we left that with 3 pages of signatures in support of the campaign. And so doing that groundwork, developing the consciousness and meeting oppressed people where they are and showing the connections and leading with Black and Palestinian solidarity, we made some intervention in that. And then I can talk a little bit more about how the campaign impacted the Historically Black College and built Black and Palestinian solidarity. But the victory in Durham is of critical importance and is very much connected to the anti-apartheid movement.
Both the U.S. and Israel have used systems of racial profiling and mass incarceration to maintain a deeply unjust status quo. Today, about a third of all African-American young men are either imprisoned or on probation or parole, while in Palestine, over 40% of Palestinian men have been in prison since 1967, according to the prisoners group at Amir. Nidal, you mentioned how imprisonment had affected your own community and your own family. Can you talk more about Israel's mass arrests, its military court system, and how prisoners are regarded in Palestinian society?
Yeah. I grew up, as I mentioned in the beginning, I grew up in a family that was in and out of prison all the time. At some point in my growing up, five of my siblings were in five different prisons at the same time. So I remember as a child, okay, we wake up at 5 in the morning, and we divide ourselves. My mother will go to this prison. Me and my other sister will go to that prison. My father, my other brother. So we despair at 5 in the morning or 4:30 in the morning to 5 different prisons. And we meet after midnight, to tell the stories of the visits of this 45-minute prisons, of my brothers and sisters inside the Israeli prison system. The prison in Israel, it's one of the most brutal places to be in for political prisoners, especially. But it is an empowering, an amazing place at the same time, where prisoners in Palestine, through struggle and hunger strikes, have achieved a lot of things to turn this prison into an academic, institution within the prisoner system. But also growing up in a refugee camp and following these issues closely, I will say one of the most effects of this incarceration system that Israel uses is left on the changing the demography of the space. I remember between 2004 to 2010, in 2000, the second Palestinian Intifada started, and by mid-2003 to middle or 2004, the Israel started building the apartheid wall within the West Bank. And at that time, this Palestinian young generation who was born during the Oslo period between 1994 and 2000, have heard about the glory of the First Intifada in the 80s and witnessed the brutality of the uprising or the conflict in 2000. And here you go, we're faced with this 8-meter concrete apartheid wall taking their land. So there was a massive movement against the process of building the wall, led by the youth and children, especially in refugee camps and villages. And Israel noticed that, and they start targeting these young male in these places through massive waves of arrests, to the point I used to take walks in other refugee camp in 2004, 5, 6, and 7 and not see much young men in the streets, you know? And these men, they start going to prison when they were like 13, 14, 15, 16, 18 years old, you know? And the same generation will be arrested once and three times. Now, many of them actually are 30, 35 years old, and they're still coming in and out of prison. And, you know, the process of going in and out of Israel prison, you will face interrogation, torture. Israel will try to break this generation, corrupt politically and morally this generation. And this left a huge impact in the community. First, you know, Palestinians are Arab, and part of the Arab culture, these young men, if they want to be independent from the family, they need to save money, build a house, furnish it, and get married, establish a family, all right? But precisely because of the incarceration, they lost the opportunity to get their college degree. They lost the opportunity to save money and be independent. And this resulted into the female presence in the camp be getting married to outside of the camp, to people who have the resources, leaving these places with a higher male presence. And you can imagine, you know, having these overcrowded places with higher male presence, young men who spend more than half their life in prison since they were like 12 and 13, 14 years old, will lead to some kind of trouble. So what Israel really missed in this calculation, that they kept arresting this generation and torturing this generation and sending them back to the same place. The overcrowded, the lack of opportunities, the lack of services. And of course, this generation, you know, will revolt, like the First Intifada generation will revolt against these hard living conditions, poverty, and they will target their anchor and resistance toward the occupation, you know? And yet, you know, Israel relied on the fact that, you know, okay, well, this will create like a type of like drugs and crimes, et cetera, et cetera. And we have a little bit of it, not much, but I think there's something this process of incarceration have built in this generation because to keep them in the line of resisting the occupation. And actually, the old generation in the prison played a role. Many of these young men, when they were arrested, they would be sent to the adult prison, where the First Intifada generation, the more educated with more experiences, took very good care of these young people inside the prison. In political education, cultural education, etc., etc. So the majority of them, they kept this solid political education and when they left out of prison. The court system, you asked me about the court system in Israel, it's a play. You know, it's a play. Here's the process quickly to conclude. Let's say they come to Ida Camp, which they come a lot, as you know, they arrest someone. So the arrest, you know, it has a stages. First, they will take this individual and put it into an Israel military camp called Rachel's Tomb military camp next to the camp. And then they will transfer this person to another detention center called Atzion around Bethlehem. And from there, they will send this person to Ofer prison near Ramallah. And from there, there's a court. The court is, you know, the caravan size. It's like a box of iron. The judge is from the army. The prosecutor is from the army. The security are from the army. So the prisoner and his or her Palestinian lawyer facing an army system. you know, because Palestinians in the West Bank, they deal with the Israeli military law. You know, the civil Israeli law is not for Palestinians, it's for the settlers and for the Israelis. The Palestinians have the military law to deal with. So practically in the history, you mentioned since 1967 until today, 40% of Palestinians have been in prison. How many cases since that time, and even before, but let's take this, that, how many cases left the court, quote-unquote, innocent or not guilty?
Zero.
That tells the story. but again, because Israel, the colonial system, they kept a lot of the British colonial system rules in the Israeli court, such as the administrative detention. It's not an Israeli law, it's a British law, you know, the collective punishment. For example, when my older sister threw a Molotov cocktail on a settler bus, nothing happened to the bus or to the settler inside the bus. This was in 82. She got really high sentence, and they demolished our house in the court. The judge issued, okay, you go to prison for this number of years, and your family house will be demolished as a collective punishment, which a practice they kept from the British mandates of Palestine before the Israeli colonization started in 1948. So the court system is a mix of their new racist laws mixed with the British racist laws to be practiced on this populations, and this is something, you know, Ramo can highlight it here in the U.S. because when I came from Palestine, I spent in 2006, I spent 6 months in New York, but immediately 2 years in the South Side of Chicago, and it was one now of an experience for me to be in the South Side of Chicago, coming from Palestine to there, which I got much of my education about the system of oppression, racism, segregation, gentrification, all of these things, but the practices and the conditions there struck me of I actually, it's weird to say it, I felt like I'm comfortable because, there's something I'm familiar with, you know? I was used to a lot of things that African American was subjected to in the South Side of Chicago. But I'll leave it to Ajamu to highlight these things if he wants to add into that.
I would add torture. They were using torture, systematic torture in Chicago at that time. But Ajamu, you had mentioned defund the police, and I'd like to hear what you think of that call. Also, the abolition movement, the prison abolition movement, spearheaded by people like Angela Davis. Can you imagine an America in which criminal justice is so radically transformed? And what do you think it would look like? How significant would it be?
Yes, I can definitely imagine that. Someone who studies the past, it is quite clear that it needs to be a radical transformation in terms of how we look at policing, how we look at prisons, how we look at punishment. And I just want to, before, you know, talking about defunding the police, what it means, what, you know, abolition of the police mean, what that demand really means, I want to just give a brief historical overview. The origins of policing has always been an oppressive institution. They started as, you know, enslaved, you know, catchers, and then in the North, you know, enemies of the working class. And then you have, you know, on the way down to the civil rights movement and other movements for black self-determination, police have always been the number one enemy. When you look at efforts to move society forward, the people who are providing the most pushback, who are the enemies of those movements for justice and transformation, are the police. And so, you know, I remind people that, you know, during the civil rights movement, when people going in the Deep South to try to achieve the most basic, you know, form of participating in the democratic process, they weren't, you know, necessarily nervous about, you know, other than the most pressing thing was the violence from the police. When you're going down a road in Mississippi or in Alabama, you're nervous about the sheriff who's pulling you over, the sheriff who's part of the Klan, you know, or, you know, the police officer who's part of the Klan. So, you know, it is almost impossible to reform a system with its all its years of function have been in an oppressive role. And of course, to, you know, the struggle for black freedom and the black community, but also to the working class, They have been major protectors of profit over people, of the economic system of capitalism, and you know, and also other forms of capitalism, the individualistic nature that it promotes. And so when you have forces who are talking about defund the police, they're like, you're spending millions of dollars on a police department who has a history and a contemporary record of brutalization of oppressed people within the United States. Why don't you spend that money towards housing, towards education, towards environmental justice, towards, you know, health, you know, all these different things. To me, a world where the police is defunded, it means we have a place where everyone has housing, everyone has health care, everyone has a job that pays a livable wage, everyone has the things they need to survive, because under the economic system society we live in today, that is not possible. The masses of people are suffering. So that's deeply tied to, in my estimation, the struggle to, you know, defund the police and abolish police. That has been the demand put forward, and the movement for Black Lives has done a good job demonstrating what that is. And, you know, instead of officers, why not have trained counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, mental health crisis experts, you know, all these different elements to deal with problems. And the struggle to defund the police and to abolish it, I think, is a struggle to say that another world is possible, that, you know, we can live without this repressive institution. It's connected to the struggle against capitalism. It's connected to the struggle to end the school-to-prison pipeline. So, you know, as I'm a high school student working to end the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, I was forced to reimagine what schools would look like without officers. And it was quite clear that schools would be much better. You're funding these officers in school. Why not fund a counselor? We don't have a nurse. We don't have, you know, we're under-resourced as a school. Books are falling apart. There's one elective, which is optional, on African-American history in a majority Black high school. So, you know, these things were coming up. So, as I said before, I think the struggle to defund the police, it has gained national attention. But of course, as the power structure does, it tries to twist, turn it, and demobilize its significance. But I think we're at a point where people are saying no and continuing to push back and make sure it's a critical part of the discussion, locally, nationally, and on a statewide level.
Thanks for that. Now, many South Africans who have visited Palestine have said with some amazement, this is worse than the apartheid system we struggled against. Still, what's amazing to me is that the PA, the Palestinian leadership, has not answered the call or strongly supported the call of civil society for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, which was of such a help in bringing to an end the South African apartheid system. So Nidal, why is this? Why has the PA been so reluctant to embrace BDS? And do you think this can change in the future?
I don't think such a system, not the leadership, talking about Palestinian Authority, can embrace such a call. And I am saying this with a pain in my stomach, actually, because these are our brothers and sisters that are breaking the system, the Palestinian Authority. You know, the Palestinian Authority has been for a while part of the problem. So we're talking about a structure, a system that was funded, was created and funded by the Western world. You know, it lives on the donors and aids from either Arab country, but also the European Unions and the U.S. So it's tied to their orders, you know. However, the PA can embrace such a call when we manage to clean and organize our own house, you know. So meaning Palestinians at home and Palestinians in the diaspora should hold the Palestinian Authority, not only the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and even the PNC and PLC, you know, accountable and to be involved in the decision making through restructuring the PLO organization, re-electing new members of the Palestinian National Council, the PLC. Through the PNC as well. Now, political fragmentation that we have in Palestine might cause serious challenges to achieve that. But this political fragmentation will be part of organizing and cleaning our own house. Even though the BDS, Israel for years cried to the West, you know, we don't have partners to negotiate with. We don't have partners, real partners, to have a peace deal with them. They're terrorists, they're violent, they want to erase us, etc., etc., etc. And here's the BDS-K movement with its core is actually calling for unity, calling for the one state, you know, calling for the one state solution with equal rights for all. I think as Palestinians, we are passing through a really dark moment, fragmented political scene. Disorganized, partially corrupted political system, mostly from the Western world, and the level of poverty, unemployment, the level of oppression and occupation in the West Bank is really weakening the streets. So we need. As Palestinians, we need to figure out a better way on how to really end this political fragmentations and unite together to reorganize ourselves from inside, and then not only embracing such a call, be as Israel, you know, investing millions of dollars, killing the BDS movements on campuses and elsewhere in the world. As Palestinians, we should be, you know, supporting and funding also the BDS movements in Palestine and abroad.
Najamu, in the U.S., the Congressional Black Caucus played a crucial leadership role in the anti-apartheid movement. And as relations of solidarity between Black Americans and Palestinians continue to be built, do you see Black Americans playing a significant role in the struggle against Israeli apartheid? I know the movement for Black Lives Matter faced huge criticism for its statements supporting Palestinian rights. Do you think this silencing effort will have a lasting impact?
I think Black people within the United States play a very important role and have been active participants in, you know, the Palestinian solidarity movement within the U.S. I mean, if you look at Students for Justice for Palestine chapters, as I look at them in different parts of the country, there are a number of, you know, Black students who are participating. If you look at a number of Black freedom organizations, you know, on the Black left, there's a position or understanding and support of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. And so I think there's a very important role. And I want to go back to the 1980s, in addition to, you know, the anti-apartheid struggle, I mean, there were organizations who were then talking about, you know, the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa and also talking about support for Palestine. I think oftentimes we, you know, talk about, you know, Malcolm X, and we talk about the Black Panthers, we talk about mixed statement, but I would argue that from what I've seen, you know, about the 1980s and even about the 1970s and, you know, not so popular Black organizations, the question of Palestine was clear. You know, it was a clear support for Palestine. And, you know, at the Black Political Convention in 1972, you know, that question was raised by Reverend Douglas Moore, who I must say was a graduate of North Carolina Central University. He was, you know, in Washington, D.C. He was there bringing the question of Palestine as like kind of non-negotiable on the agenda. And so, you know, it support for Palestine has been there for struggles. So the movement for Black Lives is part of that trend. But, you know, the power structure, as always, will try and put forward any form of intimidation. And I think, you know, from what happened to Mark Lamont Hill, which, Nancy, you know, when we were in Palestine, we found out about that was, you know, unfolding to, you know, other, you know, people who speak in support of Palestine, what happens to them. There's still a approach and a commitment, despite, you know, what comes with it, to support Palestine. And so, you know, I think it can always increase. It could always be more. I think there's always a lot to do in terms of increasing Black and Palestinian solidarity. But I think as the movement is, it's in a good position. And as we see, you know, demilitarize, so-and-so U.S. city to Palestine, that there's some level of consciousness there. There's some form of Black organizational representation within those. So I think, you know, because we're up against a power structure who doesn't want us to bring our struggles together, that we have to continue to fight and fight and fight and have that conscious raising efforts and bringing forward the question of Palestine in every way, shape, and form, continue to make those connections. But I think it's strong now. Students who are, you know, going through to universities and are part of Black student movements are, you know, playing active roles in, you know, BDS resolutions on campus, you know. So it's there and it's strong despite, you know, what we're up against.
Yeah, thank you. We just need a strong Black caucus.
They're kind of, you know, almost extraneous.
Well,
they have little teeth.
Yeah, well, we'll see. There's some hope there, I think.
Yeah, can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
I think we have to look at, too, Representative or Congresswoman Cori Bush, who, you know, unequivocally, you know, supported Palestine and is in elected office and, you know, has a political program that seems to be in a direction for the people and that is internationally aware. So, you know, it's a beautiful time, and you have the formations like Black Alliance for Peace, you know, with Ajamo Baraka and so many other forces who are demanding an end to AFRICOM, you know, U.S., you know, imperialism on the continent of Africa, which is connected, you know, to the question of the occupation of Palestine. So, you know, there's a very mature character that is developing. So I think as the crisis continues, so will our solidarity.
You have been listening to Nancy Murray, Nidal al-Azraq, and Ajamu Dillahunt discussing the intersectionality of the struggle for justice and freedom in the Black community and Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and same place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To listen to our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. And click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. خيام